And here we are in another edition of the Spoiler Room, a special one today. I'm joined with a couple special guests here. They are people involved in the brand new horror film that just had its world premiere the last weekend, and it is Headless, the, I guess you could say, sister film to the breakout indie film Found. And today in the room, we have Mr. Arthur Culifer, and Mr. Shane Beasley, and the director, and the killer from Headless. How are you gentlemen doing this evening?
Doing well.
All right.
And we'll talk. Oh, I'm doing good and ready to talk a little bit Headless here. Now, I have to ask, Arthur, what was it that spawned the idea to do a full movie of Headless? I know it, we get to see clips of it during Found, but here we actually have the full-blown 1978 lost slasher film, Headless. Was there demand from the audience, or had you always planned on possibly making this into a full-fledged film?
No, it was definitely something that the audience wanted. It was one of the most asked questions, you know, along the festival circuit, was when are we going to see a full version of Headless? I don't think that we didn't intend to make the full version when we made Found. So at that time we were able to be schlocky. Mm-hmm. It was a very it was a short moment in Found, a short film that we were making for that. So we tried to be a little over the top, and I mean basically it was just killing, you know. But when we moved to do the actual feature, I wanted it to be the actual artifact that you saw from 1978. I figured, well, that's what everybody was into. That's what they want to see. But at the same time, we didn't really want to be stuck within that story, mm-hmm. you know, that is told in that version of Headless. So we did still utilize that footage, not as much as I thought we were going to probably, but we did still utilize it, and then we were free and open to play in that killer's world.
Yes, and what a world that killer lives in. Shane, were you surprised about the popularity of your character, the killer, from the short film featured in Found? Were you happy to come back and revisit that character?
I don't know about happy about it. When we originally had the idea of having the iconic killer, like the old movies, you know, having a character that everybody's rooting for. And when we came up with a new one, we kept it. And I don't know, I really feel weird about people cheering me on. It's like they're wanting us to do despicable, bad things.
And the killer definitely does do some despicable bad things in this film, but at the same time, you kind of, there's some weird appeal to him, and I think it's the way it's written. Now, when you decided to do this in the vein of a 1978 film, Arthur, what challenges did that pose, like, for trying to give it the authentic feel that it was actually taking place in 1978? You know, props and costuming. What kind of challenges were you faced with that?
Quite a few, actually. One of the first issues, really, was that when we shot the original Headless, the first girl, Angela Denton, who is really an amazing actress. She had some like tattoos on her belly, and she had some piercings, and she had some things like that that I'm really surprised that very few people have ever brought up. So I think that we kind of went from the idea that our 1978 was going to be as close to 1978 as we could get it, but, you know, we're time traveling.
Mm-hmm.
So we may step on a few butterflies here and there. But getting the cars was rather difficult. We had cars come in and cars drop out. Happens on a project. Locations, we had them and then we didn't have them. One of the most important locations was the roller rink. And several of the roller rinks, Kara Erdell was contacting these people, and several of them, it's like, well, we want to make a movie. No. a horror movie? Hell no. So we found Bob Conley, Roller Bob, out at Cruisers in Linton, and he actually used to run his roller rink as a haunted house.
Oh.
So he was one of us from the get-go, so that was very, very fortunate. And, you know, I was very nitpicky, especially in the editing and things like that. If there was, we had a couple of scenes where there were cars in the background that were more modern cars. So I actually was insistent that we go back in there and blur them out.
Oh.
there are, like, I try my best not to. I know that somewhere along the line there's going to be a car enthusiast who's going to notice the shape of the headlights on something, you know. But
and a culture shock on a weekend Saturday.
Oh, yeah?
There was a guy who comes up and he's like, I just want to know, Ford didn't make a Ranger back in 1990. I was like, yeah, it's a 91.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really like the authenticity of the cars in it. I noticed that right off the bat, though, that it's impressed me when you had the cars in there. I was like, wow, they really went for it. And you also had the skips for where there would normally be a change in film reel. I like that. But also, when a lot of people do these vintage films, especially in the indie horror, they tend to go through and use that kind of beat up footage all the way through. Were you tempted to do that? I noticed you didn't do that till it got close to like a real change, or did you not want that to distract you from the film?
We didn't.
Yeah.
That was something that Scott and I definitely agreed on in the editing, was that we wanted, we're also film festival organizers. We have run Dark Carnival film festival, and now it's Diabolique. For the past, this will be, I guess, our ninth year doing that. So we have watched a lot of films, and that really is a hallmark of somebody trying something, but they're not trying that hard. Either that, or they just don't understand the program and how to use it, or possibly they're younger or something, mm-hmm. that they think that this is how it should be. Scott has worked as a projectionist and has changed film reels back when they were film reels, you know. And so he remembered things about it, and then we did some research as well, you know, that where the film reels were changed, right near where the cigarette burns are, is where they'll be handled the most.
Right.
So that's where you're going to have the most amount of scratching and things like that. But we didn't want it to be overwhelming. We did put our Blu-ray might be a little bit better quality than we intended it to be.
yeah, the problem of the digital age, right?
It is, because it tries to take away the grain that we just put in. Like when it compresses it, it's.
Now, you said it in the 70s, and I kind of liked it because that is when you started seeing these very disturbing horror films that come up. You know, the original Last House on the Left, the original I Spit on Your Grave, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Shane, for your motivation and kind of prepping for the killer, did you use any of those movies as inspiration, or did you just dig deep and find that dark place for yourself?
Yeah, we used a lot of inspiration from all of them. There's a little Friday 13th. There's a whole lot of Elm Street. There's the Halloween aspect. We got a little bit of everything. We want to make it look like that the 80s slashers were kind of copying off of us. That kind of feel that, yeah, we're ripping everybody off, but we get it first.
Sure. Well, you did a lot of things I don't think a lot of people have done. Like with the headless props. I have to say your killer is definitely a unique killer, and he has an interesting fetish. What was it like shooting those scenes with the headless props, and do you get a lot of jokes or questions about what you did to those heads?
A lot of people were impressed with the fact that I chose the neck instead of the mouth. I think that head probably had a little bit of a lockjaw to it, and it'd be a lot harder to penetrate, really. I think in the book, it was a thigh, and I was a little bit more manly than that.
Well, of course, you want to be able to, you know, look at them in the face.
Well, yeah.
Their eyes up so they can't.
So they can't look at you, but you can.
Yeah. It's the intimacy.
You use those as grips.
Yeah.
The ultimate POV.
Yeah, definitely. You know, they always say in film that you never work, or you try to avoid working with animals and with kids. And both in Found and Headless, you've worked with kids, Arthur. Was that a challenge, especially with some of the material that you were doing in both films?
It's always a challenge to work with children. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy it because I feel like it's a good education for them to see, excuse me, especially what's on a, you know, what goes on behind the scenes of a horror film. Maybe it makes it a little less frightening, but I don't know, it was something that I really enjoyed as a child, learning how these things were done, you know. I think that horror fans are maybe a little more naturally jumpy of people and need a little, you know, I think Dick Smith said something about putting like wax scars on his face and whatever as a way of kind of confronting his own mortality.
Sure.
You know, but we keep the kids away from anything real weird or bad. I mean, they're not around during most of these scenes. I mean, a lot of times, you know, you'll notice that Skull Boy in this, for example, we're cutting away to, you know, and that's because his scenes were shot separately from those things. So, but I tell you, definitely this time, the kids were really great to work with. You know, Olivia, we had worked with before on a film called Sequela, so we already knew that she was very well behaved, very professional. You know, was very cool. She's very cool.
She has that look.
Very creepy too. She gets that one look when with the mom. I think it was when the mom was cutting up the food or something, and she just gets that look at her face of like, that's like bad seed.
Yeah, really bad seed. Yeah,
you know, she looked real creepy.
That's now, and Caden, of course, was you know, when I met him, he's a son of Shane's friend. Mm-hmm. And I met him, and he plays football, and he was a very, you know, just well-behaved already, but the fact that he played football, you know, he can be coached. He's used to being coached. He's used to sitting around waiting. He's used to wearing heavy equipment and helmets, running around. Perfect. Perfect for what we need for Skull Boy.
That explains, too, why he seemed very comfortable around you, Shane. How was it working with Skull Boy? I kind of liked that character quite a bit. You two seem to have really good chemistry. Was it pretty easy to work with him?
Yeah, just the fact that he comes and sees it really helped out, because it was just like, you know, just follow my voice, you know, follow my cue, Caden, you know, Arthur would say, like, mama, and then he would do his mama, his click-clack move. Yeah. After we found out that we were making a horn, he decided to be the monster, and he would randomly kick me, and he was allowed to be mean to the monster, so it gave him a little sense of freedom and openness.
Yeah, he seemed to run with it and get into the character quite a bit, that Skull Boy. The sound that he makes, now, was that in post, or did he make that sound during the film? Because he makes that click noise, and that was just creepy, but I was just wondering when that was done.
That was done in post.
That was.
Yeah, that was Leah crunching on the ice for some of it, yeah. And Shane doing the noises and mixtures of things. But on the set, because the mask, if he just said it was click-clack, that was something that, like, we wanted that click-clack, and it was like that in the script, but it didn't work with his mask. His mouth didn't open far, but we had him saying mop 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 mop, and so yeah, it was very cute.
Now, not only the mask was really creepy, but I will say a lot of your effects were practical, which I give you total kudos for using a lot of practical effects. Was it tough getting all those prosthetics made? Because you do have a large amount of bodies in this film.
Yeah. You know, that's something that we sort of specialize in, is finding ways to do things as inexpensively as possible. And we've had years and years of practice at that. So, you know, for the body pit, that was just time consuming, because we spent pretty much the entire month of pre-production on making corpses for the body pit. And so we cast Ellie Church's body. We did her full body and reproduced it several times in foam and gelatin and silicone, whatever else we had around. So with some of them, like, we lay down a couple layers of latex or and then some padding, some gelatin, and then stuff it with couch foam that we
filled with great stuff.
Yeah, with great stuff. I mean, all sorts of things, that every trick in the book. We made the corpses that are the rotting skeleton corpses out of PVC pipes and duct tape and plastic bags. Saran wrap. Yeah, we took plastic bags from our lunch and stuffed it all the trash, and then turned it kind of into a ripcage, duct taped it on, then saran wrapped it on, and heat gunned it. Christina Land made a ton of skulls and teeth, eyes. I mean, it was just, we were all in there, everybody, Cole, just chipping in and making it happen. So, but it was a good deal of effects for not much money. We ran out of money as far as the effects budget goes. We were digging into the couch cushions for change, you know.
So start using real bodies, a lot cheaper, right?
It was the first day of shooting, too.
Yeah.
So we took all of our attention on that one day. And we shot a weekend. We would spend the entire week getting ready for the next weekend shoot. And so it's like, okay, we've got these scenes. Okay, what effect do we need? So we had to work on that week.
But I was also sculpting Skull Boy for a good portion of that month at work. I work third shift at a porn store.
Oh, okay.
It's very fortunate because I'm pretty much the boss while I'm there, and so I can do the things that I need to do as long as I take care of the customers. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, anyway.
I mean,
customer.
Now, I'm going to move a little bit here. A lot of people throw in some controversy on, why would you make such a disturbing film and such disturbing imagery? And, and it always gets me. People will go, well, why would you make such a story like this? So I guess I make a question for you. Where do you see Headless as far as, the extreme movies of why someone would want to make a film like Headless or say like I Spit on Your Grave or these extreme horror films? What is either your motivation or why do you think these stories need to be told?
Well, I think that our motivations were different than the films that this emulates and the films that we loved. And love, now, but growing up. I think that for Headless, there was a lot that had already been done.
Mm-hmm.
And we do love these films, so we kind of knew where the envelope wasn't pushed. Now, as far as, like, the head-fucking, that's in the novel of Found.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the killer's MO from the source material. So when it came around time to making this film, we had to make it shocking. We had to make it over the top.
They asked for it.
They asked for it. And in fact, we've had discussions as to whether or not we went far enough.
Mm-hmm.
There were other things that, we had thought about doing and, maybe do in the future, but, we had thought about doing that just didn't make it in, or maybe it was a little, I don't think we ever, aside from Nathan's puppy, that we ever said, well, that's too much.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's the rabbit. Nathan had been working on Unwelcome and still was working on that, and I felt like we, kind of needed to get the ball rolling on Headless while he was doing that, so I started coming up with ideas, and Scott had said that he wanted to see a boy in a cage.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, okay, boy in a cage. Well, maybe he's had something that's happened to him that has caused this, maybe some abusive females in his life. And kind of the core vision, I say vision because it was pretty much like that. We were talking about it, and it was like, the boy in the cage, mom's cutting up the rabbit, she's going to make him eat the head, or something, and then here comes Skull Boy out of the brush.
Right.
He kind of appeared just like that. So then, from that point, we had these few set ideas. I wanted to see, an eyeball tree. I thought that would be cool, especially with eyeballs. And we brought it to the group, and everybody kind of pitched in their ideas and talked about what they wanted to see in this sort of film, since we could do anything.
Sure.
And then, to a certain degree, we kind of, we pared it back. We handed it to Nathan to write, and he really developed the characters and threw in the body pit, and which was a nightmare for the producers, but man, that's a lot of fun. I love the body pit.
The body pit is definitely a memorable scene in there. But what's also memorable, I think, is the mask for Headless. Shane, was it fairly easy to get into character once you slid the mask on and it kind of let yourself go?
Yeah. I worked with him when he found, when you stare into the mask and you see what he wants to be. And when I put them on, it was just okay.
Oh, I'll put the mask on. You can do just about anything, like bathe yourself in.
You can't be seen.
Yeah. And we're used to being masked.
Sure.
You know. And that was something, you know, actually, when we were making Found initially, I think it was kind of just supposed to be this cheap dime store skull mask. You know, and we'd even talked about maybe just buying one. I'm like, no. I wanna make this thing. But then you'll notice he doesn't have any bottom teeth.
Mm-hmm.
That's because Shane got impatient and went ahead and cast the son of a bitch with bottom teeth in.
I thought it looked fine as it was.
And you were quite correct. It's very characteristic.
It does give him a unique characteristic in it. Make him a little more creepy too, because it's not just a face. You're missing that one section in there, you know. So that's part of him as well as the mask. So I always like that imagery of the mask that you had there. Now you do have a rather heavy female cast, because of course the killer goes after females for his victims. How did you have a number of actresses kind of lining up to be in your rather twisted film, or was it hard to find some actresses because some extreme things happened to them?
You know, it was oddly easy. That's a good way to put it. Well, Ellie, I think we kind of imagined, you know, pretty early on that we wanted her in this. And I think that Betsy is a very cool character.
Yeah.
So she's used to that sort of thing, you know. But there were other actresses, like Kelsey Carlisle, for example, who had not done that sort of thing before and wasn't really comfortable getting nude, but that's okay, because she was our final girl, and so she's supposed to maintain this sort of, you know, virginal innocence in a way. The sister also, you know, we never do see that. But it's one of those things where we did it where I feel it was necessary.
Mm-hmm.
To the story. I mean, it was a little gratuitous, especially with Ellie, because, you know, she's comfortable with that. We were happy about that, and so, like, having her skating around topless is one of the most awesome things ever.
She seemed very, very comfortable around it. Actually, I really liked her character. She really seemed to get into the role of Betsy, and especially that hair, too. I hardly recognized her, actually, with her makeup in that. Was that a wig that she had on, or
lucky wig?
Yeah, it was. We were lucky enough to find two of those. Actually, we ended up with three of them ultimately, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But we needed one for her and one for the head, you know. And we were looking for something that was kind of a Farrah Fawcett sort of do. I'm not sure that's exactly what it was, but
it was the Barbara Mandrell.
The Barbara Mandrell.
Barbara Mandrell. Well, that just brings up all kinds of images. You guys recently had your world premiere now, and what was it like seeing with the full audience? Did you get a lot of expected reactions, or some possibly unexpected reactions while people were watching?
Well, it was pretty fantastic, really, because it was snowing like crazy, and we were a little concerned that people, you know, rightfully wouldn't be able to make it out, but we had nearly a full house, and everybody was very receptive to it. In fact, I thought that, you know, when we had our opening at Culture Shock, which was great, and we thank Jason Hoover and those guys so much. When it ends and it's headless, you know, on the screen, we got a big wah! But that was our crowd, so we kind of expected it. But here in Bloomington, we didn't know what the crowd was going to be, and we kind of thought it was going to be like, but instead it was, you know. So the reception has been very positive all around so far. So we're a little surprised maybe, but certainly humbled. And think that it's really wonderful that people enjoy it, because we enjoyed it. We all loved it very much.
Mm-hmm. They're getting a joke.
They're getting the joke too. And yeah, that's another thing. I'm very happy that the sort of 78 mythos is being taken as well as it is. You know, people, I usually, you know, I'm presenting it as if it were something that was buried deep underground, and when people first saw it back in 1978, they had seizures and hallucinations and vomiting and all of that sort of thing, and that people, you know, burned the copies, and only a few circulated on VHS, you know, bootlegs for years, and so we're bringing together the most pristine copies available. But we did have an occurrence at our Bloomington premiere that is not the first time that we've had such an occurrence, but someone did pass out.
Oh, wow. way to go, Shane.
She loved us, too, and told the whole experience and her feeling like she was going to throw up. And she went to the bathroom, and she woke up in the bathroom. And then went back out to watch more of the movie.
She went to the bathroom, and her head was filled with the strangest ringing sounds, and that she couldn't even hear the outside world, and she wasn't sure she was going to make it, wasn't sure she was going to pass out. And then she did. And then she woke up feeling normal and went back for more.
Went back to watch more of the necrophilia of the killer and the slaughtering of the women. I will say you really did well in capturing the spirit of those 70 slashers. Shane, since you were playing a role that was supposed to be played in the 70s, did that give you a little bit more freedom or you know, loosen a little bit versus the way actors, I think, approach a modern-day slasher character? You know, you got to play it up, I think, a little bit. Did that make it a little bit easier because you could have a little more freedom in how you played the killer?
Oh, yeah. I definitely felt like the killer was more childlike.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he was with Cowboy around, when he was still acting with his, you know, childlike, with his, imagine your friend, you know. Mm-hmm. So he's playing, he's having fun, he's enjoying himself. It's this freedom from all of the darkness and dreariness that is his real life, you know. But so, good to have fun with it.
Somebody made the very, I feel, appropriate and interesting comment that, you know, the child is the father of the man.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And that's certainly, you know, quite visibly true in this.
that is quite visibly true in it. And yeah, the killer is kind of childlike, and Skull Boy is almost more adult than the killer is, I think, in this.
Very demanding sometimes.
You will fuck that skull.
it's true. We actually, during the punk chick scene, with Haley J. Madison playing the punk chick, totally boss, she was also really great to work with. And she, during that scene, Scott and I had in the editing, actually, he has a click clack, and then it cuts back to the killer, and there was this sort of more like pleading click clack. And we're like, no, let's cut that out. We cut that out. I kind of liked it at first, but then we cut that out, and it was very like, no, you're going to do this. Don't go ahead and speak twice. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that that he was a little more demanding of the killer. You will do this. Killer almost seemed to have a little bit of reluctance in doing some of these things, which I kind of liked in that you had a little bit, almost not quite, because, but just a tinge of sympathy for the killer, giving his backstory. I think we're going to wrap it up here, gentlemen. I want to say you do definitely have, I think, another very interesting film on your hands. You did with Found, and here you really did well, I think, with capturing that 70s slasher film feel to it. And I think that extreme films do have a place in cinema if they're done right. And the problem is I don't think a lot of people get it with extreme films. Would you say that's kind of the case? I mean, Arthur, you've watched a lot of them because of the film festival. You think some of them maybe go just too far just because, and not that it actually serves a bit of the story, but just trying to say, hey, look how bad we can be?
Well, it sounds a little strange to say that I think that some of those things are mean-spirited,
mm-hmm,
when you see Headless, and, you know, to compare it to that. But it's true. I think that Headless, as vile as it is fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good time. And when we were talking before about, movies in 1978 making extreme films, this had to be, you know, to take the people who had grown up with these films on a nostalgic journey back in time, but still be able to shock them just that much more than, you know, because they would have been a little bit shocked back in the day as children, and now as adults we want to return to that like childlike moment of like, oh my God, are they really gonna do that? So that part of it's fun. We didn't want to,
mm-hmm,
bore anyone or be too much of a, to have too much of a mean spirit towards it, because we love these films and,
Now,
the line of offensive. I don't know if we cross that line. I don't know.
I don't think the line was ever really there.
Good.
Now, do you have any showings coming up soon here for Headless?
Next viewings are, we have the Crimson Screen, Horror Film Festival in South Carolina. We have Horror Hound Weekend in Cincinnati, Ohio. We're going to New York later in the summer.
Slaughter in Syracuse
in July. We've got one in London, Ontario. Shock Stock.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And on the 12th, we'll have an international screening announced.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Spreading the word of the necrophilia skull-fucking killer.
It's what the people want to see.
Apparently so, since you did fund this through Kickstarter, correct?
Yes, we did. And we want to thank them all heartily and graciously. Thank you for helping us to bring this horror to the screen. Without the fans, this simply would not exist now.
We have no money.
And DVDs and Blu-rays, what? Oh, at the end of the month. DVDs and Blu-rays at the end of the month. Yeah.
And where can they get those? Through the website? Or?
Yeah, you will be able to...
It is headlessmovie.net.
Yeah.
Headlessmovie.net, and you'll be able to get them, or we'll do an announcement over to the Facebook page as well.
Awesome. So everyone go check out the Facebook page. That's just facebook.com/ that Headless or Headless Movie?
Headless Movie.
Headless Movie, yeah. Because there is another movie out there called Headless that is nowhere near like this film.
there are a couple, strangely, that have cropped up recently. So that's.
But I guarantee you, they don't have some of the scenes that are in this movie, to be sure.
I think they're about more delicate things.
Well, I thank you, gentlemen, for joining us and talking about Headless. Everyone check out their Facebook page. Check out headlessmovie.net you said. I'll have the link as well in the description here. And thank you all for talking, and look for Headless in a festival near you soon, or just go out and buy the disc, and then you can own a piece of Slasher history.
Yeah, come find us, come friend us on Facebook, get into the weirdness.
Yeah, we'll be around.